From NPR News, I'm Tony Cox in for Farage today. For Tuesday, February 26th, this is News and Notes. Jason Bartlett is the nation's first openly gay black state lawmaker. I talk with the Connecticut Democrat about coming out and the tough challenges coming his way. Plus, the Kings of Nubia, a National Geographic writer, talks about his latest report on Egypt's ancient black pharaohs. Also, a photo book captures a century of black life in Britain. And Freda Payne was a hit with classics like Band of Gold. Now, the veteran R&B songstress has returned to her jazz roots with a tribute to the legendary Ella Fitzgerald. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Higher costs for food, energy, and medicine caused wholesale prices to surge last month, according to the Labor Department, stoking fresh fears about inflation amidst a slowing economy. NPR's Anthony Brooks has details.
The Labor Department says the producer price index for finished goods shot up by a full percentage point last month, more than double the increase that most economists expected. That means wholesale prices have soared by 7.5% in the past 12 months, the fastest pace in more than 26 years. According to the report, gasoline prices were up by almost 3%, home heating oil jumped by 8.5%, and food prices rose by 1.7%, the biggest monthly increase in 3 years. The core inflation index, which excludes food and energy, was also up by almost a half percentage point last month, double the December increase. Rising inflation, combined with weak economic growth, is raising fresh concerns about the return of so-called stagflation, which battered the economy through much of the 1970s. Anthony Brooks, NPR News, Boston.
On another economic front, the number of U.S. homes in foreclosure jumped last month, according to the group Realty Track, which says 233,000 homeowners were in some stage of foreclosure in January, about 8% more than in December. The Senate may vote later today on whether to debate a measure that backers say would help some homeowners avoid foreclosure. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The bill would allow judges to modify mortgage terms during bankruptcy proceedings, including reducing the amount of principal owed. Sponsors say that might help hundreds of thousands of borrowers avoid foreclosure. Democrats argue that the subprime mortgage crisis and a newly reported decline in sales of existing homes is evidence some consumers need help hanging on to their homes and that the housing industry needs a boost. But lenders oppose the measure. They say it could actually increase costs for borrowers because lenders would have to charge more for loans with the risk that mortgage terms would be changed. They have support from Republicans, and it's uncertain whether Democrats can muster the 60 votes necessary to bring up the bill without making some changes. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Former Democratic presidential contender Chris Dodd has endorsed Barack Obama for the Democratic nomination. At a news conference in Cleveland today, Dodd said initially he was skeptical of what he called a new face in American politics, but he says it's time to get behind a candidacy that expresses the aspirations of millions of Americans. Obama and rival Hillary Clinton are due to debate this evening in Cleveland ahead of primaries in Ohio and Texas a week from today. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 160 points at 12,733. The Nasdaq is up 30. This is NPR News. Iraq is demanding Turkey withdraw from northern Iraq. The Turkish military is in the sixth day of an incursion into northern Iraq against PKK separatists fighting for an independent Kurdish state in Turkey. The Iraqi cabinet today called the incursion unacceptable and a violation of Iraq's sovereignty. The Senate is due to vote today on two Iraq war measures. One would cut off most funding already approved for the war in 4 months. The other requires the president to report on U.S. strategy to fight al-Qaeda around the world. For the first time ever, a major American symphony orchestra today performed in North Korea. The New York Philharmonic played a concert in the capital, Pyongyang. North Korea's leader didn't attend, but as NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, the concert was very warmly received.
Bizet's Farandole was the first of three encores the Philharmonic played at the East Pyongyang Grand Theater. After the concert, which was televised in North Korea, conductor Lauren Mazel said the North Korean response took him by surprise.
So we just went out and did our thing, and we began to feel this warmth coming back towards us, not just a polite acceptance of our presence.
Mazel said he hoped the concert would be remembered as a watershed in the gradual progress towards the normalization of U.S. and North Korean ties. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Pyongyang.
An ice vault under the frozen tundra of Norway officially opened for business today. Built inside a mountain on a remote island near the North Pole, the vault is designed to store seeds for food crops. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids and families succeed at AECF.org.
From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Connecticut has become the first state to have an openly gay black lawmaker in its General Assembly. Last week, State Representative Jason Bartlett told local reporters that he is gay. Six openly gay legislators are already serving in Connecticut, but Bartlett's announcement makes him the first African American serving in a state legislative body to be open with his homosexuality. It is one thing to be black and gay, but to be a black gay Democrat with a mostly white Republican constituency, well, on paper at least, looks challenging. Representative Jason Bartlett is with us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tony. It's great to be here.
So how big a deal do you think it is, your coming out?
Well, I think any time any public official comes out, it's a big deal still at this point in our history. For myself, it's a little bit more of a challenge. As you said in your opening remarks, my district is 96% white, so there is already a distance in terms of looking in the mirror. I don't fit the demographic as an African-American. So I was still successful on my third try. I made it to the legislature, and now I've shared with what I call my larger family and have told them that I'm gay as well. And in some ways, I guess I've increased my percentages because I went from 4% to hopefully 10%. Or maybe a combined of 14 or somewhere in that.
I was going to ask you, as a matter of fact, do you consider Connecticut to be a gay-friendly state? And I say that in part because with six other gay legislators already in office there, what the real difference might be for you as an African-American in that role?
Well, I think being African-American and gay presents certain challenges. I think I have a responsibility now to speak on some issues, both in the African-American community and in the gay community, because there's differences and there's different kinds of priorities. So I think being the first, which I didn't really recognize until I came out, puts a little bit of pressure on me to get it right and be a little bit appropriate.
What's been the response since you've come out?
It's been pretty good. I mean, we had a session day that day, and certainly my colleagues in the legislature were very positive. I got a lot of thumbs up. I got some hugs. I got some jokes thrown my way. So it was good up here in Hartford. And in terms of the district, people have emailed me. I had a gentleman email and say, you know, I'm white. I'm heterosexual. We don't have a lot in common, but I respect your decision, and I think you made the right one, and you'll get my vote.
Now, what about in your personal life? You talked about how the public has responded. What about in your family and in your personal relationships with a partner, for example?
Well, my family is known for some time, so that was a matter of, you know, touching base with them. I think there was a little bit of angst in terms of, you know, coming out publicly for them, but they've been supportive and they'll continue to be supportive. My kids, they were great. Some of their friends didn't really realize, so they had some conversations. In my personal life, I'm single at this time, so didn't have to worry about the partner's reaction.
Let me ask you about this, because when you're out and about in the public, and whether or not that's how that affects your ability to be yourself, and I say that in part because of another question I wanted to ask you, but let me get to that one first. When you're in the public, how difficult, if at all, is it for you to be who you are, and how difficult was it for you to be who you are?
Well, it's definitely, I think it's difficult. I call it placing oppression on yourself, because what you do is you create distance between yourself and your reality around you. When you do it with your family, you're keeping a secret from your family, so there's a certain intimacy that you can't have. And when you do it with the public and you're in the public eye, there's a certain distance. So you do create a certain oppression. Just in the interview, for example, I'm sitting there. I walk in, they tell me they're going to videotape the interview. So I thought about that for a second, and I said, okay. And I sat down, and, it was a little uncomfortable at first. And then about halfway through, I got a little bit more comfortable, kind of crossed my legs, starting to feel a little comfortable. And all of a sudden, in the back of my head, I said, you know what? I might look gay right now. Maybe I should uncross my legs and square my chest up and fold my hands and put them in front of them and try to look more conservative. So I think you have these little conversations with yourself, and when you're in the public eye, you're always kind of aware of how people are interpreting you and how you're coming across.
That's very interesting. Here's my final question, and I do appreciate your coming on, and it's this. You share the exact same name as a Major League Baseball shortstop for the Tampa Bay
And he's willing to do so, and he wasn't forced to do so. I think that's a good thing. I think it opens up the doors for other people in his position to do the same in the future.
Robert, you worked for a U.S. senator in D.C. who was against gay rights, and gay rights groups criticized you for working for him. How hard is it to be gay and work in the halls of Congress or any other legislative body for that matter, especially with those who may be opposed to your lifestyle?
Well, first, let me say, Tony, congratulations to Representative Bartlett for coming out, regardless of whether or not he's a public official or not. Anyone who feels trapped, who is in the closet, or whatever the terminology may be, for anyone to come out is a huge step forward, regardless of their position. To answer your question specifically, Tony, well, it's always difficult to try to, at least in my opinion, to try to differentiate between your private life and your public life. In my public life, I tried to be a professional. I tried to be a good staffer. I tried to do the best job that I possibly could. And in my personal life, I tried to keep that separate because it was separate. I was not an elected official. I was not someone who, at least at the time, I didn't think anyone cared about who I was. And so I honestly thought that continuing to be private about my private life, which was the appropriate and professional thing to do. It's unfortunate that there's some people out there that continue to try to meld the two or to try to force you to become something that you're not. So it wasn't very difficult for me to be who I was on Capitol Hill, being an African-American, being an openly gay Republican. I certainly wasn't hiding the fact that I was gay, but I certainly didn't broadcast it as well. And there's a distinct difference there.
Let me end the conversation with this. And let me first say this before I ask this question of you, Jasmine. This is a delicate topic. And at NPR, we are sensitive to it, especially when it comes to matters of privacy. Now, our policy is not to say things or to make allegations that are not first vetted by us. So in that context, let's talk about the climate that allows some gay people to feel comfortable about coming out and others not. Your organization, the Black Justice Coalition, keeps track of this very kind of thing. And according to your group, there are 6 openly gay black elected officials. So what makes Bartlett's situation unique, and why are there not more?
Well, first of all, let me just correct you for one moment. My former organization, I'm no longer on the board. I left the board when I went to Congress. But, I think, well, first of all, let me back up also. We have more than 6, actually, by the list that I'm looking at right now. And, you know, we've had over the years about 14 or 15 African Americans who have served or ran for office and been openly gay, including Edenice Simmons right now, who is the mayor of Cambridge, who's an African American lesbian.
Now, this is a person who has already become openly right. announced. Okay, go ahead.
All right. So, and I think the important thing with Representative Bartlett is that, you know, in terms of ranking, obviously, being in the state legislature, he's probably the highest ranking as of right now. We haven't, most of the people who have, you know, successfully ran for office have ran at the, sort of the local level. So we're talking city council, mayoralship positions. So I think that, again, you know, going back to what I said at the top, was that, you know, having Representative Bartlett come out, again, it opens the door for other folks. I think in if you look at the landscape in the past couple of years, there have been more and more African Americans running for elected office. But at the same time, you've had more and more African Americans who have been lesbian or gay, who have either unsuccessfully or successfully ran for political office.
Now, let me stop you to ask, and we're really running low on time. Are African Americans who are openly gay and mm-hmm. running for office, are they being elected in predominantly Black districts?
There are hardly, I look at California, we hardly have any Black districts. I think what it comes down to is we're electing people who we feel can get the job done regardless of their sexual orientation. And I think Representative Bartlett is a perfect example of that. I don't think his sexual orientation comes into play with his constituents.
I have less than 30 seconds for you, Robert. Do you agree with that assessment?
I do. Look, being gay is only part of you. It should be more about who you are as a person. It should be about what you bring to the table. And that's clearly what his constituents in Representative Bartlett's case see.
We'll stop right there. Thank you so much, Robert Trainum, a spokesperson for former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, Jasmine Kanick, a co-founder of the gay advocacy group, the Black Justice Coalition, joining us here at NPR West. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our Africa update is just ahead. We look at Somalia's ongoing humanitarian crisis, and Spain indicts 40 Rwandan officers for their roles in the African nation's genocide. And ancient Egypt's black emperors. I talk with the man who wrote National Geographic's latest cover story on the Nubian pharaohs. This is NPR News. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. On today's Africa update, is Somalia the forgotten crisis? Plus, Spain indicts 40 Rwandan military officers for genocide. And HIV-positive men get arrested in Egypt. For more, we've got Bill Fletcher. He is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of Trans Africa Forum. Bill, nice to talk to you again.
I'm glad to be back.
Let's start with Somalia. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says the lives of up to 15,000 children are at risk in Somalia unless emergency aid arrives in the next few weeks. It also says children in Somalia are more at risk than children anywhere else in the world. Now, since fighting in the capital, Mogadishu, began nearly 6 months ago, thousands have fled the city and are living in refugee camps. They are facing starvation and disease. Question number one, why does Somalia have such a pressing humanitarian crisis right now?
Well, as you know, Somalia has been in a state of almost constant turmoil since 1991 when Siad Barre was overthrown and a clan-based civil war unfolded. And the Somali state, there was no government. It basically collapsed and had been non-existent basically until the Union of Islamic Courts, an Islamist group, took over power a couple of years ago. So about a year ago, they were ousted by the Ethiopian invasion. And since then, there has been a guerrilla war that's been going on that has left most of Somalia in constant turmoil.
Is it a forgotten crisis?
I'd say yes, for the most part that it is. And it's forgotten, at least in the United States, because there's not the direct involvement of U.S. troops. There is indirect U.S. involvement, absolutely. But the you notice very often in the U.S., and therefore it's not on our screen.
One more thing about Somalia before we move on. Talking about a split there, a potential split, the Bush administration and some members of Congress are considering whether to recognize Somaliland. Tell us about that, and what concerns do you have?
Somalia as a nation was the result of the merger of two former colonies, Italian Somaliland and British Somaliland. And this took place in 1960. When Siad Barre was overthrown in 1991 and chaos ensued, a section of Somalia, the former British Somaliland, seceded and set up a government in what they called Somaliland, which is not recognized by other countries on this planet, and it has not been recognized by the United States. What's happened very recently, however, is that noises have been made, particularly out of the Department of Defense, but also out of Congress, about recognizing Somaliland because of its alleged stability, but also because of its proximity to the Red Sea and the Persian Arabian Gulf. And I think what we have to understand is that if the United States goes forward and recognizes Somaliland, it may in fact set a chain of events to unfold that over which no one will have any control. It's sort of along the lines of when Germany recognized Slovenia and later Croatia, which contributed to the dismemberment of the former Yugoslavia, that other groupings may look at this as a sign that the United States will give them recognition. And I don't mean just in Somalia. I'm talking about in other parts of the continent. So this is a very risky proposition. And I would say that it's better for the United States to try to figure out how it can help to unify Somalia rather than to splinter it.
All right, let's move on to Rwanda. A Spanish judge recently indicted 40 Rwandan military officers on several grounds of genocide, human rights abuses, and terrorism. Spain's high court has accused the officers of involvement in mass killings in the early 1990s. Now, Rwanda does not have an extradition treaty with Spain, and officials in Rwanda have denounced the indictments as politically motivated. What, Bill, is the significance of these indictments?
Very, very peculiar, Tony. These are indictments not against the people that most of us would think would be indicted. These are indictments against those who overthrew the perpetrators of the genocide. So let's just go back for a second. In 1994, Rwanda was in the middle of a civil war. In that, there were peace negotiations, and at a certain moment, the president, the then president of Rwanda, is killed when his plane is shot down. Almost instantaneously, a genocide carried out by the Hutu military against Tutsis and Tutsi allies took place, in which somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million people were killed in roughly 3 months. The perpetrators of this genocide were ultimately defeated by the forces of the Rwanda Patriotic Front, and they were driven out of Rwanda, in most cases into refugee areas in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The indictments are against individuals who were connected with the Rwanda Patriotic Front. And basically, the indictments seem to say that these individuals perpetrated crimes against the Hutus. Now, they may have. I mean, that's something that a court will have to judge. But it's very odd in that you have outside of the borders of Rwanda the equivalent of the Waffen-SS. you have these perpetrators of the genocide that are still free and are running around in often in refugee camps and have not been brought to justice. And so in that situation, going after these individuals seems a bit odd. It's not to say that they're innocent of having perpetrated crimes, but it seems that the justice is a little bit unbalanced here.
You know, something else that caught my eye, and I'd like for you to explain to the audience, is this: the connection between Rwanda and Spain, and why Spain is prosecuting these war crimes.
The technical reason that Spain is prosecuting them has to do with the murder of some Spaniards in Rwanda. And they may have been murdered, executed, or so-called collateral damage in the war that was going on between the Rwandan Patriotic Front and the Hutu perpetrators of the genocide. It's not quite clear, but basically it's because of that reason that Spain is taking these actions. And that's not a ridiculous idea. I mean, it is not unprecedented for a country to bring charges, as took place in Britain, or was about ready to take place in Britain, against the former dictator of Chile, Augusto Pinochet. So, because British people were killed when he took over in 1973. So that's not unusual that Spain would take such a step. What is unusual is that these were not the perpetrators of the genocide. When we're thinking about the Rwandan genocide, it is not about crimes that were committed against the Hutus. It really was the crimes that were committed by the Hutu military against the Tutsis and the Tutsis' allies among the Hutus.
So these indictments were brought against the people who fought against the people who caused the genocide.
Precisely, which does not mean that they are innocent. Not at all. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, though, that it's an odd set of circumstances when you have these criminals that are running around in the Eastern Congo.
Interesting. Very much. Bill, thank you so much for coming on. Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of Trans-Africa Forum. He spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters. Thanks,
thank you.
Bill.
Thank you.
Now to a largely untold chapter of African history when Nubian kings conquered ancient Egypt. The so-called Black Pharaohs ruled for nearly a half century. They played a major role in unifying the country and created glorious monuments which still stand today. Their story appears in this month's issue of National Geographic magazine. Robert Draper is the author of the article, and he joins me now. Robert, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Your most recent book, let's talk about this first, because it's curious to me, is about George W. Bush. So how did you become involved in research about Black Pharaohs?
Well, it is an interesting juxtaposition, isn't it? But in fact, one of the Black Pharaohs, arguably the mightiest of them, Taharqa, has a certain amount in common with our president in that they both have had a healthy estimation of their abilities, perhaps were possessed by hubris, no shortage of self-confidence in any event. But I do dare say that I'm probably the only individual who has gone from interviewing a sitting president in the Oval Office to 72 hours later standing on the banks of the Nile and admiring the pyramid in which Taharqa is encased.
It was a fascinating article, and the pictures were just as fascinating. One of the pharaohs that you feature is, I believe I'm pronouncing this correctly, P.A.
Correct.
And P.A.'s rule over Egypt. Talk about the significance of that particular pharaoh.
Well, P.A. was significant because he did indeed conquer Egypt, perhaps at the behest, it's still rather unclear, of elements within Egypt who believed that that Egypt had been floundering for the previous three centuries, had lost a lot of its spiritual and cultural traditions of the New Kingdom era and was riven by tribal warfare and corruption and economic decline. And so P.A., in the meantime, was a sophisticated culture that not only was, in fact, run from sort of deep in Africa, but indeed was in a lot of ways autonomous from Egypt with its own construction and burial customs. So this wasn't just the work of a bunch of cunning mimics, but for a very, very remarkable civilization in its own right.
Here's my next question. How much of this evidence, the writings, pyramids, other ancient civilization structures, let's put it that way, how much of that remains today?
Well, a fair amount, but not as much as one would like. Of course, this is, you know, the corollary, I suppose, to the victor goes the spoils, that to the subjugated go ruins. And the Nubians, since they were in power for only about a century and were much despised by the Assyrians and others, had many of their likenesses defaced and, in fact, obliterated. For example, the Pia, whom you mentioned, the great pharaonic ruler of the black pharaoh, we don't even know what he looks like. We only know that his skin color was black. And so to some degree, we are reliant on the conquerors of the Nubians to describe Nubian contributions, which, of course, is a very, very tenuous way to view Nubian history.
Would that explain why some of the pharaohs, the images of the pharaohs in the article, they look as much Eurocentric as Afrocentric?
Well, to some degree, yeah. There's again a lot of sort of flip flopping that you see among archaeologists and among these renderings, and there's a lot of blurred lines too. You know, there's a line that I mentioned in the story that's drawn a fair amount of interest and that says that the ancient world was devoid of racism, which is not to suggest that there wasn't subjugation or enslavement or discrimination on the basis of class or culture, but pigment itself was not the marker in the ancient world that it would later become. And African women who were married by Egyptian royalty didn't just become concubines; they were oftentimes queens, and we see likenesses of these queens. The children of these of conquered Nubians were often schooled by the finest Egyptian tutors. And so there are all these blurred distinctions. You see in Egypt dark-skinned warriors and light-skinned warriors side by side. And it's very telling, I think, that race isn't so much of a marker. But viewed through 19th and 20th century eyes, I think that became a point of confusion.
Your suggestion, and we have about 30 seconds, your suggestion in the article was that the emphasis on skin color actually came out of Europe later
that's
on.
Yes, that's exactly right, and archaeologists in later years would be very much influenced by the thinking of that time. But that was not the way it was back then. Egyptians looked down on Nubians, but they looked down on everybody. They looked down on Libyans and Asians. They believed themselves to be superior. But that was much more of a civilization thing than a skin color thing.
Robert Draper, thank you so much. Robert Draper is a contributing writer for National Geographic magazine. He wrote this month's cover story, Black Pharaohs. You can see pictures of the Nubian kings at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. Robert, once again, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Next on News and Notes, a focus on Black Britain. A new photo collection documents a century of the life and culture of blacks in the United Kingdom. And the latest from StoryCorps Griot. You're listening to News and Notes from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from John and Catherine Debs, funding the Bay Area Women's and Children's Center, providing service to low-income families, at bawcc.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
They're the web conversations that have Black America buzzing.
The hip-hop generations are really serious about trying to establish a political identity.
30,000 combat troops are indeed making a difference.
What is the issue with some of the other issues that don't deal with dogs but human beings?
What's making news this week? I'm Farai Chidea. Find out on our Bloggers Roundtable, Wednesdays on News and Notes from NPR News.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. From Britain's World War I armed forces, to London's red-hot reggae scene, to the stunning jab of boxing great Lennox Lewis, Blacks have made a decisive mark on British life over the last 100 years. A new book called Black Britain, A Photographic History, aims to tell some of that story. It captures the life and culture of West Indian and African immigrants, as well as native Black Britons. The collection also turns a lens on Black Brits and their fight for inclusion and equality. Paul Gilroy wrote Black Britain and helped compile the pictures. He is a professor of social theory at the London School of Economics, and he joins me now. Paul, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you.
Let's start with this. What is your personal connection to the work and the images in this book?
Well, for me, this was a labor of love. I've been living in the U.S. I came back to England. It's my homeland. I came back to London, my home city. And I felt that the culture of the young Black people in particular here was suffering from a kind of deficit, historically speaking. There were younger people in my neighborhood who were bereft of history, who took their idea of themselves from watching their kind of generic hip-hop video material that they got from the video screen rather than really inquiring into the particular history and experience of our communities in this country.
As I looked at the book, I was trying to find a theme, and I don't know if I found one or not. What was, in your view, the major trends or themes that you saw unfolding over the century that are depicted in these photographs?
Well, I wanted the photographs to convey our claims on citizenship and our belonging to this country. There are a lot of images drawn from the history of our military service, for example. I didn't want the story to tell a history only of, you know, sports and music as the center of our contribution to British life. I wanted the younger people in particular to be aware of the history of struggles, the history of protests, which had filled out our right to belong and our right to be recognized as British people, if that's what we want to do.
One of the photographs that you have in there that caught my eye actually does do a couple of things. It is sports, but it also speaks to what you are talking about. It's on page 219, and the caption reads, "Fans of the West Indies cricket team celebrating their win over England at Lord's Cricket Ground, London, August 27th, 1973. Now, the photo is filled with smiling, celebrating Black folks. One man is being hoisted onto his friend's shoulders with a tie around his neck and a cap on his head. And to me, the interesting thing here is this. Black people in England celebrating the defeat of England's national cricket team. Why is that picture interesting to you? And what does it say about how Blacks have worked out their own identity issues inside Britain?
Well, for much of my own life, I mean, my mother was a migrant to this country in the 1950s. For much of my early life, I guess we weren't really allowed to belong. One of my books is entitled "There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack." That was a chant that the white fans would sometimes raise up at the cricket games. So I think to be here, to be in this country, and to defeat England at its own game, you know, that was something which had a strong symbolic resonance, a power, which was important to us. And it's something that's all the more significant as a historical memory now, that history isn't, that cricket isn't quite as important as it used to be, you know. The tall kids don't join the West Indies cricket team now. They go off to play basketball instead.
I noticed that you also had a number of American figures in photographs, and a wide range from Paul Robeson, Stokely Carmichael, Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali. Talk about the inclusion of the Americans there and what their meaning to Brits, black Brits, was.
Well, of course, you know, our becoming black people in the modern world was very reliant at certain points, not just on the cultures we brought with us from the Caribbean and from Africa, but also on the impact and the guidance and the political leadership and imagination of African Americans. And I wanted that to be part of the story that's here as well. You know, the Jubilee Singers are here. Claudia Jones, I guess she wasn't African American, but she came here from the United States after she was expelled from the country. But someone who came in and started the Caribbean carnivals, which have become Europe's biggest street festivals now. So I wanted that link to be present. I wanted people to think about the idea that Martin Luther King and all the others, Malcolm, had been here, had been part of making our political community aware of itself as part of, a diaspora of African peoples scattered across the overdeveloped countries.
Along that line, did you see it as a parallel universe, American black experience and British black experiences?
No, I think they're in many parts of our history very closely interconnected. For example, there are images in the book of the African-American military presence here during World War II, something which is not, you know, necessarily part of the history of black America itself. I mean, I wanted the people there, too, to look at these images and think, well, yeah, we did travel. Our culture had some reach in this world.
Final thing is this. It is a fascinating book and very interesting photographs for people to look at. The thing about radio is you could just never show pictures really well on radio, no matter how hard we try. But let me ask you this as my closing question. Is there a photograph in this collection that really speaks to you and speaks to what you want the reader or the viewer to get? I've got about a minute for that answer.
Well, one of my favorite images is of the women queuing up to get into the cricket match with their rosettes. And their dress, their expressions on their faces, there's something about the fact that they're there at all, you know, that tells you that this game is more than a game, that it has an importance in terms of understanding their power in the world and their resistance to the kind of white supremacy that delimited their life chances and restricted them to second-class people here. And all of that's in the images. It's etched on their faces. It's etched in the kind of passionate, caring glances that they give back to the camera.
Paul Gilroy wrote and compiled the book Black Britain, A Photographic History. He is a professor of social theory in the sociology department at the London School of Economics. He joined us from London. Paul Gilroy, thank you very much for coming on with
us. Thank you. I'm so happy to have that chance.
On Tuesdays, we listen in on StoryCorps Griot, the project that's recording the stories of African Americans across the country. Today, we hear from Wydenia Perry and Essie Gregory. They are old friends and traveling companions. Here, they remember some of their adventures around the world. Wydenia begins their conversation.
Girl, it's been over 30-some years since we've been traveling together. What are some of the most memorable places that you've been to?
Don't ask me that question, because every place I've been, I've loved. We have visited over 125 countries, visited every continent except Antarctica. How do you expect me to narrow it down to one?
Think about St. Petersburg. When we left Moscow to go to St. Petersburg, remember the overnight train?
How can I forget that? When St. Petersburg was changed from Leningrad back to St. Petersburg.
Right. All the people in the street going crazy and knocking down all the statues of Lenin. That was something else, wasn't it? When we step back and think about all the things that we visit, you know, Germany with Eastern Bloc Europe.
Yeah, I'm still fascinated about that wall they built.
Oh, I got the piece of the wall. Did you get a piece?
No.
I got a piece.
South Africa?
South Africa.
And we wanted to take pictures of the parliament, and it wasn't allowed. And the guards were on us immediately.
Where did they come from?
And Wydenia is so smart. She said, well, let's take a picture of you all. And they loved taking pictures so much, they were ready to pose. And when they posed over there, they were standing in front of the parliament and didn't realize.
Wasn't that smart?
We got the picture.
I thought that was kind of cute.
Absolutely.
You know, when you sit down and think about it, we really had some adventure.
Wasn't it Fiji where I almost got married?
That's right. You promised to go back and marry that prince.
And remember, I drank all that Carver.
I found out what Carver is afterwards. It's an aphrodisiac.
Yeah, I found out that night. I want you to know, it was nice traveling to you with all these countries.
We still got hundreds of more
to do. We will continue to do it. Yes, we will.
Okay, and I'll see you on our way to Antarctica.
Absolutely. Okay. Don't forget, it's my birthday.
I know.
And my 60th birthday.
Something special, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'll get you a suitcase.
Wydenia Perry and Essie Gregory in Harlem. The two friends just hit their goal of visiting all seven continents. They returned from Antarctica today. StoryCorps Griot has just finished its national tour, but you can still record your Griot interview at any StoryCorps booth around the country. All the Griot Initiative recordings are archived at the Library of Congress. A copy of each interview will also go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. Hear more at nprnewsandnotes.org.
StoryCorps is sponsored by AT&T. Funding for StoryCorps Griot comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
She had the Motown sound before Motown was Motown. R&B singer Freda Payne had the hearts and minds of a generation with hits like Band of Gold and Bring the Boys Home. Now she's back with her signature sound. With a run at Feinstein's at Lowe's Regency in New York City, she'll be giving classic standards a new twist, performing hits made famous by jazz legend Ella Fitzgerald. But before Freda hit it big, she was a late-blooming child. She talked about her beginnings with me here at NPR West and said that until the age of 12, there was one teensy thing that was keeping her from her destiny.